If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back to RCR Greenwashed with Jaspreet and Don. And following on from the interview with Bryce McKenzie of Groundswell last week, we thought we'd get Jamie McFadden, Groundswell's environment spokesman, to come along and talk about his experiences in Wellington now a fortnight ago. So welcome to the show, Jamie. You're a former Hiranui councillor, Groundswell's environment spokesman. You've been a Federated Farmers North Canterbury president, I recall. And so now you're busy running a business, planting trees and planning landscapes and things like that. You're a busy man. How did Wellington go on top of all that? How did it go up in the big smoke?
Well, it went pretty well, but we're 25 years now, our nursery business, our EcoSource native planting business, and the work we do for farmers. We've been going 25 years this year. I wasn't president of FEDS, but I was on Provincial Federated Farmers twice. Yeah.
Okay.
I knew I was making an error right then.
Yeah, that's all good. In terms of my impressions of Wellington, I guess we're hearing lots of different things about the regulations, but it's important for people to understand exactly what is being said and what is being progressed. Because it's early days yet, really, and the proof is going to be in the pudding when we see the legislative changes come forward, and then they've got to go through the consultation process and then the decision flowing out from that. But it's very, very important to look into the wording that has been written around some of these policies. And I'm thinking of SNAs and SASMs and, you know, these sorts of things, freshwater farm plans.
Yeah, so this is something that mystifies me. We have a change of government, and the process after that seems to take, if you want to change something, seems to take forever. It's like realigning the deck chairs takes some time, and yet we've seen government act on things overnight in other instances. If there's an important, really vitally important thing to do, they can actually change the law overnight. But in this instance, it takes so much time. Does that frustrate you, Jamie?
I guess I can understand that from us, you know, that there is a lot of work that goes into putting these regulations in place. And like with the SNAs, the significant natural areas, what the government have done there is that they have suspended any new SNAs for the next 3 years. And that comes from the requirement in the National Policy Statement, Indigenous Biodiversity. And so that's something that's only just come out last year, but the Resource Management Act has actually had SNAs in place since 1991. So there's sort of some, I guess there's some technical hoops that the government have to work through. And so they're actually not touching all of those SNAs that have been bought in over the last 30 odd years. They're only suspending new ones. That is the requirement under this National Policy Statement, Indigenous Biodiversity. So yes, it is frustrating, but there is quite a bit of work to go on and unraveling. Some things can be unraveled quite quickly, and some things are actually just going to take some time.
So a point of clarification for me is the relatively new classification, it seems, of terms, sites and areas of significance to Maori, SASMs. I was telling Jaspreet, and I think I've mentioned it on the show, that I don't ever recall that term ever being put in front of me by any advisors that I had for my 20-odd years after the RMA was enacted. So it's a relatively new classification, I gather, but how the heck did that get into being if it wasn't in the RMA in Section 6?
It is in the Yeah, it is in section six of the RMA.
But was it there from day one? Why is it only
Yes.
in recent years it appears to be rising to prominence?
Okay. That's a very good question, and I'd love to know the answer to that. But I've got my theory on it. When the RMA came in, councils jumped on this SENA's one, which is Section 6C, and they rolled out significant natural areas, outstanding landscapes, which is, there's different parts of Section 6. So the one that they didn't really roll out was the SASMs, the Sites and Areas of Significance to Māori, and that has only just reared its head in the last, seems to be 4 or 5 years. What has happened in local government is that it's sort of like got like a snowball. So one or two councils started doing it, and then other councils thought, "Oh, that's a good idea. We'll do it too." But this is where I've learned a lot about local government, and particularly about how much councils, public agencies, MPs are influenced and managed by the management, the bureaucracy. So what has happened is that councillors, elected councillors and mayors, have not been calling for SASMs to be implemented. It has been done through the management. And the management have been putting this up to all the different councils and saying, "Oh, look, we think this needs to be done. It's Section 6E in the RMA and it needs to be addressed." And these other councils have done it. And so that's how it comes about. And for some reason, I haven't, and I've asked our local council, what actually suddenly started the SASMs process in the last 4 or 5 years? Whether it was something from the Ministry of the Environment to the councils, I'm not sure why it's just suddenly taken off. But it has been there for, 30 odd years,
30
but it's
years.
only just now. I think also probably because it was a sensitive subject and councils were a little bit loath to dive into it in a hurry because of sensitivities around, the cultural aspect to it.
Well, it's that may be so, but as I said, I spent at least 20 years involved in getting advice on the RMA, especially on Section 6. And I never ever heard that mentioned by any of our policy advisors. And that's why why I asked the question. It is a big surprise. And you've explained your thoughts about why, but it's a big surprise to me that it rears its head in the last 6 years. It's quite a coincidental change of government, perhaps at that time as well, 6 years ago. So I'm putting two and two together and making five, perhaps, but I smell a rat.
So do I.
Well, something has certainly set it off,
Sure.
and I think part of it too is that those that are driving this particular SASMs, what will we call it, policy or agenda, have seen that district plans is a good mechanism to get cultural sites so-called protected, because they think if they map these areas and then have rules around them, then they protect them. Whereas what I outlined to Timaru District Council their hearings last week, I said you're actually destroying the value of these cultural sites by using the RMA as a blunt tool, mapping all of these areas of private land and applying rules. And they're actually turning the cultural values. I said you're actually going against the purpose of the RMA, which is about, you should be recognising providing for the protection of these areas. But how do you protect these areas if you're actually turning them into a liability, which is what they're doing? But others have sort of seen this as an opportunity to get, I guess, these cultural sites locked into the legislation, which is completely the wrong approach to address this issue.
Now, seeing that all of these, be it SNAs, be it SASM, just as Don said, that I smell a rat myself, and they're all from the same Section 6. No one can say that it was an obscure section, subsection somewhere that we didn't see. They all come out of Section 6. But the government, as you said, Jamie, has only stopped work on the SNAs, that's the instruction, not on the SASMs or anything else.
Yeah, so that was a key message of ours to Wellington last week. We presented the Primary Production and Environment Select Committees. That was a joint hearing. We met with National MPs, MPs, and we also met with New Zealand First all separately. And this was a key message of ours, was that the problem's not SNAs, it's not SASMs, it's not outstanding landscapes, it's Section 6. Section 6 is the problem, because we've, I think last time I was on radio, we've had communication with a group in Wellington, and they're called Voluntary Heritage Group, and they're fighting another Section 6 aspect, which is heritage. And interesting, their concerns about Section 6 are exactly the same as ours. It's overriding private property, no respect for private property, it's impacting property values. And they've been raising exactly the same concerns as us from an urban perspective on the heritage issues. So the key thing here is that Section 6 is the problem. And we've made this clear to the government and said you need to stop all Section 6 as soon as you can.
And that goes right to the heart of the issue for me. 1991, enacting the RMA. I'm told in the draft, private property rights were recognised and full compensation would be available for takings in the public interest. But when it came to being voted on in the House on the final document, that was taken out. And ever since then, it's been a well, it's been a balloon just growing, this movement to take private property without compensation and with abandon, really. They can just come in. There's a process, but in the end, private property rights are seriously impacted. And I think that's the nub of all this. 1991, RMA had one gap, one glaring gap, and that was the recognition for private property rights. And so we're in 2024. Is there any chance that the reforms of the RMA are going to, aside from sorting out Section 6, the RMA might actually have a clause in it that says there will be recognition for property rights and there will be full compensation for taking in the public interest. Do you think that's around the corner?
I think one of the things that stood out last week was that everyone we spoke to in terms of the select committees and MPs were surprised at the extent of the SASM issue. They were not aware. And when we outlined that 500,000 hectares of the Waitaki district, which is 700,000 hectares, when we explained that 72, 70 Percent, over 70% of the district, 500,000 hectares, 500,000 hectares had been captured under SASMs, the faces all just dropped. When we explained the Timaru district, half of the district, over 50% of the Timaru district land area has been captured as SASMs, thousands of property owners. I think one of the things that came out of, or one of the things that did come out of last week, is that the penny is dropping, that there's a big problem with Section 6. And that's something we've consistently had feedback from people right across New Zealand. So I'm confident that this current government is becoming aware of the issue to the extent that they're going to implement change. I'm not sure if compensation is enough, if you know what I mean. I mean, this is private land. These are values that people, whether it's wetlands, cultural sites, SASMs, or SNAs, as one of the farmers in Timaru said to me, you know, our family have protected these historical drawings, cultural values for generations. And it would be nice if the council and the local iwi actually came to us and said, thank you for doing this. Now, how can we help you? Instead, he's got his farm mapped as an as a SASM, and he's got these rules that, and he's not, he doesn't know, you know, what it all means and what the future holds for him now. I see that there's going to be some change to the Section 6. But to what extent? I think this is a key question for all of these issues that we're seeing that the coalition government's changing. There's going to be some change, but is it to the extent that we need? Does it go far enough? And I'm nervous already that when you read that wording around SNAs, when you read the wording around freshwater farm plans, when you read the wording, it's not courageous. It's not bold. It's very careful. Yeah.
So a point of clarification that when I talked about compensation, I added in front of the word compensation, I used the word full. That is critical. My advice way back was that you can ask for compensation, but that's just not enough. You need to use the term full compensation, and that includes compound interest from the day things started to be hindered. I remember that was a case around Esplanade Reserves being taken, where I learnt that sort of need to use the right terminology. So anyway, let's park that. You know, the process is well underway, you'd think. You're getting a feeling it is well underway, even though it seems glacial pace to me. And you're confident that we're going to get some action, you know, before midwinter?
Yeah, I think when you look at the number of changes this government's made already, there has been quite a lot of changes.
And I agree.
We should acknowledge that. I mean, they came out of the blocks actually firing. There's a whole lot of changes. You know, some of them were minor, but they've made a lot of changes. And I guess that's why people are getting a bit nervous, and you can see that reflected in the polls. But I say good on them for being courageous and bold. And the reason why they've made a lot of changes is because previous governments have made such a hash of the whole environmental regulation space that there's so much broken and so much wrong that there's so much needed to be fixed. Mm. So I guess that's where this government is at. In terms of, I mean, we'll just keep pushing for it to be moved along as fast as possible. And you know, things, what we did last year was, last week, was we highlighted areas where we felt the government weren't onto it and they weren't moving fast enough. And so SASMs was a key topic for us. Freshwater farm plans was another one, because the government haven't done anything with freshwater farm plans at the moment. They've made some sort of vague acknowledgement that there needs to be some changes. But nothing around actually the legislation, as Colin Hurst, the Fed spokesman, said. He said it's a complete dog, and it is. There's so much wrong with it, it should be actually repealed, and they need to go back to the drawing board on that one.
I'd agree. And every time I hear the, let's just have voluntary farm plans, and but they'll still be in a rule somewhere, and I'm saying, well, what's voluntary about that? You've got to be very wary about the gift of voluntary when you know that it's potentially in the rules for the district or the Crown. So, I think you're right, Jamie. There's plenty of people in the side been waiting to take up positions in MPI, for instance. I note the increased headcount in MPI and even MFE in recent times, all looking, and let alone local councils, all looking to be compliance officers inside the farm gate. And it is all paid for by the farm. The environment pays for everything. And yet it's like it's a blank check that you give them. It's a big number. What I remember reading from the likes of Colin Hurst, the pending cost for a freshwater farm plan for a farm that would then be audited every so often. Can you give some indication to our listeners what that plan might look like and what cost it would be?
I mean, there's been figures floated around sort of around that $10,000 mark. I mean, as a ballpark figure for having your freshwater farm plan properly prepared, certified to a state that it then, you know, is I guess legal. But there's so many different aspects to this freshwater farm plan. And it's not just a cost, a straight out cost aspect. It's a time value, a time factor aspect as well. And that's where you're seeing a lot of farmers burning out, is the all of the different things, that they have to do now. And you add on to that freshwater farm plans, and sure, they'll probably add indigenous biodiversity into these farm plans, and then they'll add emissions, and you know, it just becomes a massive consent to farm.
Yeah.
And so in terms of the costs, there's the straight out costs, but then there's also your own time. And I mean, this talk about farmers would be able to prepare their own farm plans under the existing legislation, I mean, that's complete nonsense. I mean, people that claim that have not read the legislation, because when you read the legislation and understand what has to go into the freshwater farm plans, it's extensive.
It's very prescriptive.
Yeah, it's very prescriptive. Now, if I'm writing, like when I looked at the qualifications that you had to be for a certifier, my gosh, it's extensive. I mean, I'm nowhere near being able to be a certifier, because you have to have so much knowledge. You have to know the legislation. You have to know all of the freshwater rules in your district plans and your regional plans at a national level. Your certified plan has to meet all those rules, regardless of whether they're workable or not, and a lot of them are unworkable. There's so many fish hooks in this freshwater farm plans. But I guess one of the positives we've seen just recently with the freshwater farm plans, there's been a couple of positive steps. One is the West Coast Regional Council. And myself and one of our local coordinators on the West Coast, George Coates, we did a presentation to the West Coast Regional Council on freshwater farm plans. And they've accepted our submission, which is great. And what they've done is they've hit pause on freshwater farm plans. The second thing they've done is that this again was what we were requesting, they've prioritised where are their key freshwater issues. And then the third thing is they're going to implement actions targeted at where those freshwater priority issues are, and that includes using voluntary farm plans. Now, these were all things that we requested, so it's great to see one of the councils actually hitting pause and taking a responsible action. And I've just learned yesterday that Marlborough District Council have done the same. Now, I'm interested in that because last week, while we were up in Wellington, I raised the Marlborough District Council and said that farmers were complaining because the Marlborough District Council were going ahead with freshwater farm plans. And the MPs seemed surprised that was actually happening. And so, interesting, just yesterday, Marlborough District Council have hit the pause. Unlike Otago Regional Council, which have just ignored, what the government has requested, and they're just plowing on ahead.
Talking of these regional councils, Jeremy, you've recently had a win as the chairman of RAND Rural Advocacy Network against Environment Canterbury, getting them to take back a report on the effects of farming on the braided rivers. Would you expand on that, please?
Okay. So what ECAN did, our regional council here in Canterbury, is they produced it was a scientific report. it was produced by scientists. Yeah, it was reviewed internally. It was peer reviewed independently from an external organisation, being NIWA. And then it was ticked off by the chief scientist of Environment Canterbury. What this report did in a nutshell was that it produced science explaining the amount of land along river next to braided rivers that had been converted to intensive farming, intensive agricultural development. When it first came out, and it actually came out as an article in the local and stuff, when it came out, I immediately knew something was wrong, because one of our local rivers here, it said that 80%, this report said 80% of the river margin land had been converted to intensive agricultural development. Now, we knew this was wrong. This was the Blythe River, one of our smaller braided rivers here in Canterbury. And we've spent 12 months trying to raise this with ECAN. They have denied, they have just completely denial over there being an issue with what we've been raising. What we did was we got a commissioned an independent report, cost us $8,000. So this is through Rural Advocacy Network, the group I'm chair of. And what that report found was that it wasn't 80% of the Blythe River that had been converted. It was 0%. 0%. No land had been converted to intensive agricultural development as claimed by the ECAN report. What we then did was ask the person that did it, the work for us, to then look at some of the other rivers to see if flaws, the similar flaws applied to other rivers. And he came back and said, yes, the same flaws apply to other rivers. That information was then taken to ECAN, and I wasn't involved in that meeting, but one of the local residents was involved in that meeting. And ECAN came straight back to me and said, oh, we're withdrawing the report, and we're offering to pay for all of your costs in that independent review. But this is not the first time that we've pulled ECAN up on this. And of course, NIWA were involved, and there's quite a lot of other aspects to this saga that give me no confidence in our public agencies when it comes to science, whether that's ECAN or NIWA, or it's appalling what's gone on. And I must say that if anyone wants to read the article by Stuart Smith, our MP, he wrote the most incredible opinion piece on this ECAN saga, and he absolutely nailed it about how you know it causes the general population to lose trust in public agencies and their science. So this is just opening the lid on what is a major problem within our scientific institutions.
It is really sad. You have NIWA verifying it. You have the chief scientist internal verifying it, and yet it is completely not worth the paper it's written on. But again, what are your thoughts? Why were they even commissioning such a report? Where were they going to head to with these? Because if I know the cynical me, they are always there for a reason. They're going to be feeding into something else.
Yeah. There's stories within stories, isn't there?
Yeah, there is.
One of the things that's quite useful for people to do is do Official Information Act requests of councils. And when you do Official Information Act requests, think about the type of information you really want to get, because it's quite powerful how you construct your Official Information Act request. So what I did was I requested information not just on the initially, ECAN and NIWA refused to release the independent review that was done by NIWA. And after quite a lot of back and forth, ECAN released a heavily redacted version, which meant you got the report, but a lot of it was blacked out, so you couldn't actually read it. So we went back to ECAN, and eventually they released the full report. NIWA still refused to release the full report. They probably weren't aware that we'd actually requested it through ECAN as well. But the second aspect to this was that two of those scientists involved in the report, plus the NIWA peer reviewer, became part of a group called... what was it called? Something about, anyway, they formed this group, and they used that report as submission to government to seeking changes in relation to legislation on braided rivers.
Yeah.
And so what's going on here? Well, you know, when you really dig into this, I mean, people have got to, if they're scientists, they have to be completely independent. They have to divorce their personal viewpoints or their personal agendas, and separate that out from giving us science that we can 100% rely on. And I think that's too hard. Obviously, that's too hard for some people to do that.
Oh, I think it's endemic in our public service, to be honest. I think that is a serious problem through all our agencies. I mean, yeah, I'm not besmirching the characters, characteristics of everybody. But I sense this is far wider than what you've been managing to expose locally. Yeah. It's a big issue. And I'd like to know the perpetrators, what happens to them? Do they just go and get their wage check the following week and keep writing stuff? Or do they get reprimanded? Do they get terminated?
Does that a consultant who's written such a report, do they get blacklisted? Do they never get another council contract? There have to be some repercussions here to ensure this doesn't happen again.
Yeah, there has to be accountability, and we certainly haven't finished with this yet. And a lot of people have said to us, you need to drive for accountability here, and there needs to be some repercussions and some steps. But, I mean, this is, like you say, Don, the problem with this is that it's an endemic issue throughout public agencies, councils, and what essentially seems to have happened more and more over time is that the management are very much the drivers, and very strongly in plenty of councils. Some councils the electeds have got probably a little bit more control, but most of the councils are heavily influenced by the management, and it's not just what the management put up in front of the councillors, it's what they're not putting up.
And
that's a key thing with when I was on council for 6 years on a district council. It's understanding the information that you're not getting. And so I see it as a major problem with, and this is something that we need to put some energy into with the local government elections coming up. When are they? Next year, are they, Jasprit, I think?
Yes, about 15 months to go.
Yeah. So this is something that the people, the general population, take note of those councillors. Look at the West Coast Regional Council and, the good work that they've done in pausing the freshwater farm plans. Take note of those councils that are working in the best interests of their communities, and take note of those that aren't. Like Otago Regional Council, understand which of those councillors are trying to push through the freshwater agenda of the previous Labor government, and vote them out, because they're not acting in your best interest. So take some time to understand the way that different councillors voted, and vote those out that are not looking after your best interests.
Mm. Look, there's a lot of stuff in this, Jamie. I think you have been a breath of fresh air to this whole subject. I know Federated Farmers does good work, but your involvement with Groundswell as well has really lifted the lid on this. And, it's heartening to know that there are people willing to fight as vociferously as you, and you do it with such, with cautiousness. You do it with a style that takes people with you. So I think that's your attribute that's great to witness. The thing that gets me is the tardiness of some councillors to even, they know it's not right, but they just can't bring themselves to be sort of an outlier within their group. And that's disappointing. I just hope that, as you say, in the next elections, we can get strong councillors to stand tall, and you're leading the way, encouraging them. So.
Do we hope by chance, Jamie, you're putting your hand up again for next year's elections? You've been behind that table a while ago.
No, I've done my 6 years on a council and then 6 years on Fed. So, and now I'm with Groundswell. But with what you say there, Don, I mean, there's a couple of, with that ECAN issue and with the Haywen stuff, the Haywaki Kanoa, the emissions tax. Yep. With those issues, I mean, when you see the material that I put out, I'm a strong believer in honesty and, around information. And like that ECAM one just so incensed me because it was dishonest. And that's a key driver for me, is that just give us honesty. And with that honesty, goes integrity. There's probably three words. Integrity is another one. And the third one was what you mentioned, Don, was courage. If you're being honest and striving for honesty, and you might be a lone voice, but just be courageous and stand up, because we need more and more people to stand up for honesty. And that takes courage to do that when you're only one or two councillors around the table. And I've been in that position when I was two votes always to, Jaspreet will know what this is like. I mean, I was two votes to eight for a long time. And, you know, my fellow councillor and I, Kerry Prenter, you know, he's we were always the two, but eventually we started to turn the council. And it took some time, but once we started to turn the council, we turned that ship around, and, you know, we got rid of all of the old councillors at the next election. Well, the people did. The people spoke.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so, you know, stay true to your honesty and integrity, and stay true to your community. I mean, you're there for your community. You're not there for your for the management or for the regulation agenda or for ambition or anything else. You're there for the community. So I think those are some key things that we need to look at for the next elections when we're looking at people standing.
Right. Well, fantastic. We've had you back on, Jamie. We will look for another update in a few months' time. We love your style. We love the way you present your case. And I hope our listeners are getting wiser to what's actually happening around us in terms of our local governance, let alone our central governance. So thanks for coming back on, RCR, and we'll see you soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Sherby. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.